I'd like to go dancing at least once a week. I'd like to have nice clothes all the time. I'd like to be able to buy the kids nice clothes every time they need it without having to wait. Lori needs a new little outfit right now for Easter, and I'd like to get Gary a little suit or something. He's old enough. I'd like you to have a new suit, too. You really need a new suit more than he does. And I'd like us to have a place of our own. I'd like to stop moving around every year or every other year. Most of all, she said, I'd like us both to just live a good, honest life without having to worry about money and bills and things like that. You're asleep, she said.
I'm not, he said.
I can't think of anything else. You go now. Tell me what you'd like.
I don't know. Lots of things, he mumbled.
Well, tell me. We're just talking, aren't we?
I wish you'd leave me alone, Nan.
He turned over to his side of the bed again and let his arm rest off the edge. She turned too and pressed against him. Mike?
Jesus, he said.
Then,
All right, let me stretch my legs a minute, then I'll wake up.
in a while, she said, Mike, are you asleep? She shook his shoulder gently, but there was no response. She lay there for a time, huddled against his body, trying to sleep. She lay quietly at first, without moving, crowded against him and taking only very small, very even breaths. But she could not sleep. She tried not to listen to his breathing, but it began to make her uncomfortable. There was a sound coming from inside his nose when he breathed. She tried to regulate her breathing so that she could breathe in and out at the same rhythm he did. It was no use. The little sound in his nose made everything no use. There was a webby squeak in his chest, too. She turned again and nestled her bottom against his, stretched her arm over to the edge, and cautiously put her fingertips against the cold wall. The covers had pulled up at the foot of the bed, and she could feel a draft when she moved her legs. She heard two people coming up the stairs to the apartment next door. Someone gave a throaty laugh before opening the door. Then she heard a chair drag on the floor. She turned again. The toilet flushed next door, and then it flushed again. Again, she turned, onto her back this time, and tried to relax. She remembered an article she'd once read in a magazine. If all the bones and muscles and joints in the body could join together in perfect relaxation, sleep would almost certainly come. She took a long breath, closed her eyes, and lay perfectly still, arms straight along her sides. She tried to relax. She tried to imagine her legs suspended, bathed in something gauze-like. She turned onto her stomach. She closed her eyes, then she opened them. She thought of the fingers of her hand lying curled on the sheet in front of her lips. She raised a finger and lowered it to the sheet. She touched the wedding band on her ring finger with her thumb. She turned onto her side and then onto her back again. And then she began to feel afraid. And in one unreasoning moment of longing, she prayed to go to sleep. Please, God, let me go to sleep. She tried to sleep. Mike, she whispered. There was no answer. She heard one of the children turn over in the bed and bump against the wall in the next room. She listened and listened, but there was no other sound. She laid her hand under her left breast and felt the beat of her heart rising into her fingers. She turned onto her stomach and began to cry, her head off the pillow, her mouth against the sheet. She cried, and then she climbed out over the foot of the bed. She washed her hands and face in the bathroom. She brushed her teeth. She brushed her teeth and watched her face in the mirror. In the living room, she turned up the heat. Then she sat down at the kitchen table, drawing her feet up underneath the nightgown. She cried again. She lit a cigarette from the pack on the table. After a time, she walked back to the bedroom and got her robe. She looked in on the children. She pulled the covers up over her son's shoulders. She went back to the living room and sat in the big chair. She paged through a magazine and tried to read. She gazed at the photographs, and then she tried to read again. Now and then a car went by on the street outside, and she looked up. As each car passed, she waited, listening, and then she looked down at the magazine again. There was a stack of magazines in the rack by the big chair. She paged through them all. When it began to be light outside, she got up. She walked to the window. The cloudless sky over the hills was beginning to turn white. The trees and the row of two-story apartment houses across the street were beginning to take shape as she watched. The sky grew whiter, the light expanding rapidly up from behind the hills. Except for the times she had been up with one or another of the children, which she did not count because she had never looked outside, only hurried back to bed or to the kitchen, she had seen few sunrises in her life, and those when she was little. She knew that none of them had been like this, not in pictures she had seen, nor in any book she had read had she learned a sunrise was so terrible as this. She waited, and then she moved over to the door and turned the lock and stepped out onto the porch. She closed the robe at her throat. The air was wet and cold. By stages, things were becoming very visible. She let her eyes see everything until they fastened on the red winking light atop the radio tower across the opposite hill. She went through the dim apartment, back into the bedroom. He was knotted up in the center of the bed, the covers bunched over his shoulders, his head half under the pillow. He looked desperate in his heavy sleep, his arm flung out across her side of the bed, his jaws clenched. As she looked, the room grew very light, and the pale sheets whitened grossly before her eyes. She wet her lips with a sticking sound and got down on her knees. She put her hands out on the bed. "God," she said. "God, will you help us, God?" she said. Put yourself in my shoes. The telephone rang while he was running the vacuum cleaner. He had worked his way through the apartment and was doing the living room, using the nozzle attachment to get at the cat hairs between the cushions. He stopped and listened, and then switched off the vacuum. He went to answer the telephone. "Hello," he said. "Myers here."
"Myers," she said. "How are you? What are you doing?"
"Nothing," he said. "Hello, Paula."
"There's an office party this afternoon," she said. "You're invited. Carl invited you."
"I don't think I can come,"
Myers said. "Carl just this minute said, get that old man of yours on the phone. Get him down here for a drink. Get him out of his ivory tower and back into the real world for a while. Carl's funny when he's drinking. Myers?"
"I heard you," Myers said.
Myers used to work for Carl. Carl always talked of going to Paris to write a novel, and when Myers had quit to write a novel, Carl had said he would watch for Myers' name on the bestseller list.
"I can't come now," Myers said.
"We found out some horrible news this morning," Paula continued, as if she had not heard him. "You remember Larry Gadinas? He was still here when you came to work. He helped out on science books for a while, and then they put him in the field, and then they canned him. We heard this morning he committed suicide. He shot himself in the mouth. Can you imagine? Myers?"
"I heard you," Myers said.
He tried to remember Larry Gadinas and recalled a tall, stooped man with wireframe glasses, bright ties, and a receding hairline. He could imagine the jolt, the head snapping back.
"Jesus," Myers said. "Well, I'm sorry to hear that."
"Come down to the office, honey, all right?" Paula said. "Everybody is just talking and having some drinks and listening to Christmas music. Come down," she said.
Myers could hear it all at the other end of the line. "I don't want to come down," he said. "Paula?" A few snowflakes drifted past the window as he watched. He rubbed his fingers across the glass and then began to write his name on the glass as he waited. "What? I heard," she said. "All right," Paula said. "Well, then why don't we meet at Voyle's for a drink, Myers?"
"Okay," he said. "Voyle's, all right."
"Everybody here will be disappointed you didn't come," she said. "Carl especially. Carl admires you, you know. He does. He's told me so. He admires your nerve. He said if he had your nerve, he would have quit years ago. Carl said it takes nerve to do what you did. Myers?"
"I'm right here," Myers said. "I think I can get my car started. If I can't start it, I'll call you back."
"All right," she said. "I'll see you at Voyle's. I'll leave here in 5 minutes if I don't hear from you."
"Say hello to Carl for me," Myers said.
"I will," Paula said. "He's talking about you." Myers put the vacuum cleaner away. He walked down the two flights and went to his car, which was in the last stall and covered with snow. He got in, worked the pedal a number of times, and tried the starter. It turned over. He kept the pedal down. As he drove, he looked at the people who hurried along the sidewalks with shopping bags. He glanced at the gray sky, filled with flakes, and at the tall buildings with snow in the crevices and on the window ledges. He tried to see everything, save it for later. He was between stories, and he felt despicable. He found Voyle's, a small bar on a corner next to a men's clothing store. He parked in back and went inside. He sat at the bar for a time and then carried a drink over to a little table near the door. When Paula came in, she said, "Merry Christmas," and he got up and gave her a kiss on the cheek. He held a chair for her. He said,
"Scotch?"
"Scotch," she said, then, "Scotch over ice," to the girl who came for her order. Paula picked up his drink and drained the glass.
"I'll have another one, too," Myers said to the girl. "I don't like this place," he said after the girl had moved away.
"What's wrong with this place?" Paula said. "We always come here."
"I just don't like it," he said. "Let's have a drink and then go someplace else."
"Whatever you want," she said. The girl arrived with the drinks. Myers paid her, and he and Paula touched glasses. Myers stared at her. "Carl says hello," she said. Myers nodded. Paula sipped her drink. "How was your day today?" Myers shrugged. "What'd you do?" she said.
"Nothing," he said. "I vacuumed."
She touched his hand. "Everybody said to tell you hi." They finished their drinks. "I have an idea," she said. "Why don't we stop and visit the Morgans for a few minutes? We've never met them, for God's sake, and they've been back for months. We could just drop by and say hello, where the Myerses. Besides, they sent us a card. They asked us to stop during the holidays. They invited us. I don't want to go home," she finally said, and fished in her purse for a cigarette. Myers recalled setting the furnace and turning out all the lights before he had left, and then he thought of the snow drifting past the window.
"What about that insulting letter they sent telling us they heard we were keeping a cat in the house?" he said.
"They've forgotten about that by now," she said. "That wasn't anything serious anyway. Oh, let's do it, Myers. Let's go by."
"We should call first if we're going to do anything like that," he said.
"No," she said. "That's part of it. Let's not call. Let's just go knock on the door and say hello, we used to live here, all right? Myers?"
"I think we should call first," he said.
"It's the holidays," she said, getting up from her chair. "Come on, baby." She took his arm and they went out into the snow. She suggested they take her car and pick up his car later. He opened the door for her and then went around to the passenger's side. Something took him when he saw the lighted windows, saw snow on the roof, saw the station wagon in the driveway. The curtains were open and Christmas tree lights blinked at them from the window. They got out of the car. He took her elbow as they stepped over a pile of snow and started up the walk to the front porch. They had gone a few steps when a large bushy dog hurtled around the corner of the garage and headed straight for Myers. "Oh, God," he said, hunching, stepping back, bringing his hands up. He slipped on the walk, his coat flapped, and he fell onto the frozen grass with the dread certainty that the dog would go for his throat. The dog growled once and then began to sniff Myers' coat. Paula picked up a handful of snow and threw it at the dog. The porch light came on, the door opened, and a man called, "Buzzy!" Myers got to his feet and brushed himself off. "What's going on?" the man in the doorway said. "Who is it?" "Buzzy, come here, fellow. Come here." "We're the Myerses," Paula said. "We came to wish you a Merry Christmas."
"The Myerses," the man in the doorway said.
"Get out. Get in the garage, Buzzy. Get."
"It's the Myerses,"
the man said to the woman who stood behind him, trying to look past his shoulder.
"The Myerses," she said. "Well, ask them in. Ask them in, for heaven's sake."
She stepped onto the porch and said, "Come in, please. It's freezing. I'm Hilda Morgan, and this is Edgar. We're happy to meet you. Please, come in." They all shook hands quickly on the front porch. Myers and Paula stepped inside, and Edgar Morgan shut the door.
"Let me have your coats. Take off your coats," Edgar Morgan said. "You're all right?"
he said to Myers, observing him closely, and Myers nodded.
"I knew that dog was crazy, but he's never pulled anything like this. I saw it. I was looking out the window when it happened."
This remark seemed odd to Myers, and he looked at the man. Edgar Morgan was in his 40s, nearly bald, and was dressed in slacks and a sweater and was wearing leather slippers.
"His name is Buzzy," Hilda Morgan announced and made a face. "It's Edgar's dog. I can't have an animal in the house myself, but Edgar bought this dog and promised to keep him outside."
"He sleeps in the garage," Edgar Morgan said. "He begs to come in the house, but we can't allow it, you know."
Morgan chuckled.
"But sit down if you can find a place with this clutter. Hilda, dear, move some of those things off the couch so Mr. and Mrs. Myers can sit down."
Hilda Morgan cleared the couch of packages, wrapping paper, scissors, a box of ribbons, bows. She put everything on the floor. Myers noticed Morgan staring at him again, not smiling now. Paula said,
"Myers, there's something in your hair, dearest."
Myers put a hand up to the back of his head and found a twig and put it in his pocket.
"That dog," Morgan said and chuckled again. "We were just having a hot drink and wrapping some last-minute gifts. Will you join us in a cup of holiday cheer? What would you like?"
"Anything is fine," Paula said.
"Anything," Myers said. "We wouldn't have interrupted." "Nonsense," Morgan said. "We've been very curious about the Myerses. You'll have a hot drink, sir?" "That's fine," Myers said. "Mrs. Myers," Morgan said.
Paula nodded.
"Two hot drinks coming up," Morgan said. "Dear, I think we're ready too, aren't we?" he said to his wife. "This is certainly an occasion."
He took her cup and went out to the kitchen. Myers heard the cupboard door bang and heard a muffled word that sounded like a curse. Myers blinked. He looked at Hilda Morgan, who was settling herself into a chair at the end of the couch.
"Sit down over here, you two,"
Hilda Morgan said. She patted the arm of the couch.
"Over here, by the fire. We'll have Mr. Morgan build it up again when he returns."
They sat. Hilda Morgan clasped her hands in her lap and leaned forward slightly, examining Myers' face. The living room was as he remembered it, except that on the wall behind Hilda Morgan's chair, he saw three small framed prints. In one print, a man in a vest and a frock coat was tipping his hat to two ladies who held parasols. All this was happening on a broad concourse with horses and carriages.
"How is Germany?"
Paula said.
She sat on the edge of the cushion and held her purse on her knees.
We loved Germany,
Edgar Morgan said, coming in from the kitchen with a tray and four large cups. Myers recognized the cups.
Have you been to Germany, Mrs. Myers? Morgan asked.
We want to go, Paula said. Don't we, Myers? Maybe next year, next summer, or else the year after, as soon as we can afford it. Maybe as soon as Myers sells something. Myers writes.
I should think a trip to Europe would be very beneficial to a writer, Edgar Morgan said.
He put the cups into coasters.
Please help yourselves.
He sat down in a chair across from his wife and gazed at Myers.
You said in your letter you were taking off work to write.
That's true, Myers said and sipped his drink.
He writes something almost every day, Paula said.
Is that a fact?
Morgan said.
That's impressive. What did you write today, may I ask?
Nothing, Myers said.
It's the holidays, Paula said.
You must be proud of him, Mrs. Myers, Hilda Morgan said.
I am, Paula said.
I'm happy for you, Hilda Morgan said.
I heard something the other day that might interest you,
Edgar Morgan said. He took out some tobacco and began to fill a pipe. Myers lighted a cigarette and looked around for an ashtray, then dropped the match behind the couch.
It's a horrible story, really, but maybe you could use it, Mr. Myers.
Morgan struck a flame and drew on the pipe.
Grist for the mill, you know, and all that,
Morgan said and laughed and shook the match.
This fellow was about my age or so. He was a colleague for a couple of years. We knew each other a little, and we had good friends in common. Then he moved out, accepted a position at the university down the way. Well, you know how these things go sometimes. The fellow had an affair with one of his students.
Mrs. Morgan made a disapproving noise with her tongue. She reached down for a small package that was wrapped in green paper and began to affix a red bow to the paper.
According to all accounts, it was a torrid affair that lasted for some months,
Morgan continued.
Right up until a short time ago, in fact. A week ago, to be exact. On that day, it was in the evening, he announced to his wife. They'd been married for 20 years. He announced to his wife that he wanted a divorce. You could imagine how the fool woman took it, coming out of the blue like that, so to speak. There was quite a row. The whole family got into it. She ordered him out of the house then and there. But just as the fellow was leaving, his son threw a can of tomato soup at him and hit him in the forehead. It caused a concussion that sent the man to the hospital. His condition is quite serious.
Morgan drew on his pipe and gazed at Myers.
I've never heard such a story, Mrs. Morgan said. Edgar, that's disgusting.
Horrible, Paula said. Myers grinned.
Now there's a tale for you, Mr. Myers,
Morgan said, catching the grin and narrowing his eyes.
Think of the story you'd have if you could get inside that man's head.
Or her head, Mrs. Morgan said. The wife's. Think of her story. To be betrayed in such a fashion after 20 years. Think how she must feel.
But imagine what the poor boy must be going through, Paula said. Imagine having almost killed his father.
Yes, that's all true, Morgan said. But here's something I don't think any of you has thought about. Think about this for a moment. Mr. Myers, are you listening? Tell me what you think of this. Put yourself in the shoes of that 18-year-old co-ed who fell in love with a married man. Think about her for a moment, and then you see the possibilities for your story.
Morgan nodded and leaned back in the chair with a satisfied expression.
I'm afraid I don't have any sympathy for her, Mrs. Morgan said. I can imagine the sort she is. We all know what she's like. That kind preys on older men. I don't have any sympathy for him either. The man, the chaser. No, I don't. I'm afraid my sympathies in this case are entirely with the wife and son.
It would take a Tolstoy to tell it and get it right, Morgan said.
No less than a Tolstoy. Mr. Myers, the water is still hot.
Time to go, Myers said.
He stood up and threw his cigarette into the fire.
Stay, Mrs. Morgan said. We haven't gotten acquainted yet. You don't know how we have speculated about you. Now that we're together at last, stay a little while. It's such a pleasant surprise.
We appreciated the card and your note, Paula said.
The card?
Mrs. Morgan said. Myers sat down.
We decided not to mail any cards this year, Paula said. I didn't get around to it when I should have, and it seemed futile to do it at the last minute.
You'll have another one, Mrs. Myers,
Morgan said, standing in front of her now with his hand on her cup.
You'll set an example for your husband.
It was good, Paula said. It warms you.
Right,
Morgan said.
It warms you. That's right. Dear, did you hear Mrs. Myers? It warms you. That's very good. Mr. Myers,
Morgan said and waited.
You'll join us?
All right,
Myers said and let Morgan take the cup. The dog began to whine and scratch at the door.
That dog. I don't know what's gotten into that dog,
Morgan said. He went to the kitchen, and this time Myers distinctly heard Morgan curse as he slammed the kettle onto a burner. Mrs. Morgan began to hum. She picked up a half-wrapped package, cut a piece of tape, and began sealing the paper. Myers lighted a cigarette. He dropped the match in his coaster. He looked at his watch. Mrs. Morgan raised her head.
I believe I hear singing, she said.
She listened. She rose from her chair and went to the front window.
It is singing. Edgar?
She called. Myers and Paula went to the window.
I haven't seen carolers in years, Mrs. Morgan said.
What is it?
Morgan said. He had the tray and cups.
What is it? What's wrong?
Nothing's wrong, dear. It's carolers. There they are over there across the street,
Mrs. Morgan said.
Mrs. Myers,
Morgan said, extending the tray.
Mr. Myers, dear.
Thank you,
Paula said.
Muchas gracias,
Myers said. Morgan put the tray down and came back to the window with his cup. Young people were gathered on the walk in front of the house across the street, boys and girls with an older, taller boy who wore a muffler and a top coat. Myers could see the faces at the window across the way, the Ardrys. And when the carolers had finished, Jack Ardrey came to the door and gave something to the older boy. The group moved on down the walk, flashlights bobbing, and stopped in front of another house.
They won't come here, Mrs. Morgan said after a time.
What? Why won't they come here?
Morgan said and turned to his wife.
What a goddamn silly thing to say. Why won't they come here?
I just know they won't,
Mrs. Morgan said.
And I say they will,
Morgan said.
Mrs. Myers, are those carolers going to come here or not? What do you think? Will they return to bless this house? We'll leave it up to you.
Paula pressed closer to the window, but the carolers were far down the street now. She did not answer.
Well, now that all the excitement is over,
Morgan said and went over to his chair. He sat down, frowned, and began to fill his pipe. Myers and Paula went back to the couch. Mrs. Morgan moved away from the window at last. She sat down. She smiled and gazed into her cup. Then she put the cup down and began to weep. Morgan gave his handkerchief to his wife. He looked at Myers. Presently, Morgan began to drum on the arm of his chair. Myers moved his feet. Paula looked into her purse for a cigarette.
See what you've caused,
Morgan said as he stared at something on the carpet near Myers' shoes. Myers gathered himself to stand.
Edgar, get them another drink,
Mrs. Morgan said as she dabbed at her eyes. She used the handkerchief on her nose.
I want them to hear about Mrs. Attenborough,
Mr. Myers writes. I think he might appreciate this.
We'll wait until you come back before we begin the story.
Morgan collected the cups. He carried them into the kitchen. Myers heard dishes clatter, cupboard doors bang. Mrs. Morgan looked at Myers and smiled faintly.
We have to go, Myers said. We have to go. Paula, get your coat.
No, no, we insist, Mr. Myers, Mrs. Morgan said. We want you to hear about Mrs. Attenborough, poor Mrs. Attenborough. You might appreciate this story too, Mrs. Myers. This is your chance to see how your husband's mind goes to work on raw material.
Morgan came back and passed out the hot drinks. He sat down quickly.
Tell them about Mrs. Attenborough, dear, Mrs. Morgan said.
That dog almost tore my leg off, Myers said, and was at once surprised at his words. He put his cup down.
Oh, come, it wasn't that bad, Morgan said. I saw it.
You know writers, Mrs. Morgan said to Paula. They like to exaggerate.
The power of the pen and all that, Morgan said.
That's it, Mrs. Morgan said. Bend your pen into a plowshare, Mr. Myers.
We'll let Mrs. Morgan tell the story of Mrs. Attenborough,
Morgan said, ignoring Myers, who stood up at that moment.
Mrs. Morgan was intimately connected with the affair. I've already told you of the fellow who was knocked for a loop by a can of soup.
Morgan chuckled.
We'll let Mrs. Morgan tell this one.
You tell it, dear. And Mr. Myers, you listen closely, Mrs. Morgan said.
We have to go, Myers said. Paula, let's go.
Talk about honesty, Mrs. Morgan said.
Let's talk about it, Myers said. Then he said, Paula, are you coming?
I want you to hear this story, Morgan said, raising his voice. You will insult Mrs. Morgan. You will insult us both if you don't listen to this story.
Morgan clenched his pipe. Myers, please, Paula said anxiously. I want to hear it. Then we'll go. Myers? Please, honey, sit down for another minute. Myers looked at her. She moved her fingers, as if signaling him. He hesitated, and then he sat next to her. Mrs. Morgan began.
One afternoon in Munich, Edgar and I went to the Dortmunder Museum. There was a Bauhaus exhibit that fall, and Edgar said, the heck with it, let's take a day off. He was doing his research, you see. The heck with it, let's take a day off. We caught a tram and rode across Munich to the museum. We spent several hours viewing the exhibit and revisiting some of the galleries to pay homage to a few of our favorites amongst the old masters. Just as we were to leave, I stepped into the ladies' room. I left my purse. In the purse was Edgar's monthly check from home that had come the day before, and $120 cash that I was going to deposit along with the check. I also had my identification cards in the purse. I did not miss my purse until we arrived home. Edgar immediately telephoned the museum authorities. But while he was talking, I saw a taxi out front. A well-dressed woman with white hair got out. She was a stout woman, and she was carrying two purses. I called for Edgar and went to the door. The woman introduced herself as Mrs. Attenborough, gave me my purse, and explained that she too had visited the museum that afternoon and while in the ladies' room had noticed a purse in the trash can. She, of course, had opened the purse in an effort to trace the owner. There were the identification cards and such giving our local address. She immediately left the museum and took a taxi in order to deliver the purse herself. Edgar's check was there, but the money, the $120, was gone. Nevertheless, I was grateful the other things were intact. It was nearly 4 o'clock, and we asked the woman to stay for tea. She sat down, and after a little while she began to tell us about herself. She had been born and reared in Australia, had married young, had had three children, all sons, been widowed, and still lived in Australia with two of her sons. They raised sheep and had more than 20,000 acres of land for the sheep to run in, and many drovers and shearers and such who worked for them at certain times of the year. When she came to our home in Munich, she was then on her way to Australia from England, where she had been to visit her youngest son, who was a barrister. She was returning to Australia when we met her, Mrs. Morgan said. She was seeing some of the world in the process. She had many places yet to visit on her itinerary.
Come to the point, dear, Morgan said.
Yes, here is what happened then. Mr. Myers, I'll go right to the climax, as you writers say. Suddenly, after we had had a very pleasant conversation for an hour, after this woman had told about herself and her adventurous life down under, she stood up to go. As she started to pass me her cup, her mouth flew open, the cup dropped, and she fell across our couch and died. Died! Right in our living room. It was the most shocking moment in our lives. Morgan nodded solemnly. God, Paula said. Fate sent her to die on the couch in our living room in Germany, Mrs. Morgan said.
Myers began to laugh.
Fate sent her to die in your living room,
he said between gasps.
Is that funny, sir? Morgan said. Do you find that amusing?
Myers nodded. He kept laughing. He wiped his eyes on his shirt sleeve.
I'm really sorry, he said. I can't help it. That line, fate sent her to die on the couch in our living room in Germany. I'm sorry.
Then what happened?
He managed to say.
I'd like to know what happened then.
Mr. Myers, we didn't know what to do, Mrs. Morgan said. The shock was terrible. Edgar felt for her pulse, but there was no sign of life. And she had begun to change color. Her face and hands were turning gray. Edgar went to the phone to call someone. Then he said, open her purse, see if you can find where she's staying. All the time, averting my eyes from the poor thing there on the couch, I took up her purse. Imagine my complete surprise and bewilderment, my utter bewilderment, when the first thing I saw inside was my $120, still fastened with the paperclip. I was never so astonished.
And disappointed, Morgan said. Don't forget that. It was a keen disappointment.
Myers giggled.
If you were a real writer, as you say you are, Mr. Myers, you would not laugh,
Morgan said as he got to his feet.
You would not dare laugh. You would try to understand. You would plumb the depths of that poor soul's heart and try to understand. But you are no writer, sir.
Myers kept on giggling. Morgan slammed his fist on the coffee table and the cups rattled in the coasters.
The real story lies right here in this house, this very living room, and it's time it was told. The real story is here, Mr. Myers, Morgan said.
He walked up and down over the brilliant wrapping paper that had unrolled and now lay spread across the carpet. He stopped to glare at Myers, who was holding his forehead and shaking with laughter.
Consider this for a possibility, Mr. Myers, Morgan screamed. Consider! A friend, let's call him Mr. X, is friends with Mr. and Mrs. Y, as well as Mr. and Mrs. Z. Mr. and Mrs. Y and Mrs. Z do not know each other, unfortunately. I say unfortunately, because if they had known each other, this story would not exist because it would never have taken place. Now, Mr. X learns that Mr. and Mrs. Y are going to Germany for a year and need someone to occupy their house during the time they are gone. Mr. and Mrs. Z are looking for suitable accommodations, and Mr. X tells them he knows of just the place.
But before Mr. X can put Mr. and Mrs. Z in touch with Mr. and Mrs. Y, the Ys have to leave sooner than expected. Mr. X, being a friend, is left to rent the house at his discretion to anyone, including Mr. and Mrs. Y. I mean Z. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Z move into the house and bring a cat with them that Mr. and Mrs. Y hear about later in a letter from Mr. X. Mr. and Mrs. Z bring a cat into the house, even though the terms of the lease have expressly forbidden cats or other animals in the house because of Mrs. Y's asthma. The real story, Mr. Myers, lies in the situation I've just described. Mr. and Mrs. Z, I mean, Mr. and Mrs. Y's moving into the Z's house, invading the Z's house, if the truth is to be told. Sleeping in the Z's bed is one thing, but unlocking the Z's private closet and using their linen, vandalizing the things found there, that was against the spirit and letter of the lease. And this same couple, the Z's, opened boxes of kitchen utensils marked "Don't Open" and broke dishes when it was spelled out in that same lease that they were not to use the owner's, the Z's, personal, I emphasize, personal possessions.
Morgan's lips were white. He continued to walk up and down on the paper, stopping every now and then to look at Myers and emit little puffing noises from his lips.
"And the bathroom things, dear, don't forget the bathroom things," Mrs. Morgan said. "It's bad enough using the Z's blankets and sheets, but when they also get into their bathroom things and go through the little private things stored in the attic, a line has to be drawn."
"That's the real story, Mr. Myers," Morgan said. He tried to fill his pipe. His hands trembled and tobacco spilled onto the carpet. "That's the real story that is waiting to be written."
"And it doesn't need Tolstoy to tell it," Mrs. Morgan said.
"It doesn't need Tolstoy," Morgan said.
Myers laughed. He and Paula got up from the couch at the same time and moved toward the door.
"Good night,"
Myers said merrily. Morgan was behind him.
"If you were a real writer, sir, you would put that story into words and not pussyfoot around with it either."
Myers just laughed. He touched the doorknob.
"One other thing," Morgan said. "I didn't intend to bring this up, but in light of your behavior here tonight, I want to tell you that I'm missing my 2-volume set of Jazz at the Philharmonic. Those records are of great sentimental value. I bought them in 1955, and now I insist you tell me what happened to them."
"In all fairness, Edgar," Mrs. Morgan said as she helped Paula on with her coat, "after you took inventory of the records, you admitted you couldn't recall the last time you had seen those records."
"But I am sure of it now," Morgan said. "I am positive I saw those records just before we left, and now I'd like this writer to tell me exactly what he knows of their whereabouts. Mr. Myers?"
But Myers was already outdoors, and taking his wife by the hand, he hurried her down the walk to the car. They surprised Buzzy. The dog yelped in what seemed fear and then jumped to the side.
"I insist on knowing," Morgan called. "I am waiting, sir."
Myers got Paula into the car and started the engine. He looked again at the couple on the porch. Mrs. Morgan waved, and then she and Edgar Morgan went back inside and shut the door. Myers pulled away from the curb.
"Those people are crazy," Paula said.
Myers patted her hand.
"They were scary," she said.
He did not answer. Her voice seemed to come to him from a great distance. He kept driving. Snow rushed at the windshield. He was silent and watched the road. He was at the very end of a story. Jerry and Molly and Sam. As Al saw it, there was only one solution. He had to get rid of the dog without Betty or the kids finding out about it. At night. It would have to be done at night. He would simply drive Susie, well, someplace later he'd decide where, open the door, push her out, drive away. The sooner the better. He felt relieved making the decision.
Any action was better than no action at all, he was becoming convinced. It was Sunday. He got up from the kitchen table where he had been eating a late breakfast by himself and stood by the sink, hands in his pockets. Nothing was going right lately. He had enough to contend with without having to worry about a stinking dog. They were laying off at Aerojet when they should be hiring. The middle of the summer, defense contracts led all over the country, and Aerojet was talking of cutting back. Was cutting back, in fact, a little more every day. He was no safer than anyone else, even though he'd been there 2 years going on three. He got along with the right people, all right. But seniority or friendship, either one, didn't mean a damn these days. If your number was up, that was that. And there was nothing anybody could do. They got ready to lay off. They laid off. 50, 100 men at a time. No one was safe. From the foreman and supers right on down to the man on the line. And 3 months ago, just before all the layoffs began, he'd let Betty talk him into moving into this cushy 200 a month place. Lease with an option to buy. Shit. Al hadn't really wanted to leave the other place. He had been comfortable enough. Who could know that 2 weeks after he'd moved, they'd start laying off? But who could know anything these days? For example, there was Jill. Jill worked in bookkeeping at Weinstock's. She was a nice girl, said she loved Al. She was just lonely, that's what she told him the first night. She didn't make it a habit, letting herself be picked up by married men, she also told him the first night. He'd met Jill about 3 months ago, when he was feeling depressed and jittery with all the talk of layoffs just beginning. He met her at the Town and Country, a bar not too far from his new place. They danced a little, and he drove her home, and they necked in the car in front of her apartment. He had not gone upstairs with her that night, though he was sure he could have. He went upstairs with her the next night. Now he was having an affair, for Christ's sake, and he didn't know what to do about it. He did not want it to go on, and he did not want to break it off. You don't throw everything overboard in a storm. Al was drifting, and he knew he was drifting, and where it was all going to end he could not guess at. But he was beginning to feel he was losing control over everything. Everything. Recently, too, he had caught himself thinking about old age after he'd been constipated a few days, an affliction he had always associated with the elderly. Then there was the matter of the tiny bald spot and of his having just begun to wonder how he would comb his hair a different way. What was he going to do with his life, he wanted to know. He was 31. All these things to contend with, and then Sandy, his wife's younger sister, giving the kids, Alex and Mary, that mongrel dog about 4 months ago. He wished he'd never seen that dog. Or Sandy either, for that matter. That bitch. She was always turning up with some shit or other that wound up costing him money. Some little flim-flam that went haywire after a day or two and had to be repaired. Something the kids could scream over and fight over and beat the shit out of each other about. God! And then turning right around to touch him through Betty for $25. The mere thought of all the 25 or 50 buck checks, and the one just a few months ago for 85 to make her car payment. Her car payment, for God's sake, when he didn't even know if he was going to have a roof over his head. Made him want to kill the goddamn dog. Sandy. Betty and Alex and Mary. Jill. And Susie the goddamn dog. This was Al. He had to start someplace. Setting things in order, sorting all this out. It was time to do something. Time for some straight thinking for a change. And he intended to start tonight. He would coax the dog into the car undetected and, on some pretext or another, go out. Yet he hated to think of the way Betty would lower her eyes as she watched him dress, and then later, just before he went out the door, ask him where, how long, etc., in a resigned voice that made him feel all the worse. He could never get used to the lying. Besides, he hated to use what little reserve he might have left with Betty by telling her a lie for something different from what she suspected. A wasted lie, so to speak. But he could not tell her the truth. Could not say he was not going drinking, was not going calling on somebody,
was instead going to do away with the goddamn dog and thus take the first step towards setting his house in order. He ran his hand over his face, tried to put it all out of his mind for a minute. He took out a cold half quart of Lucky from the fridge and popped the aluminum top. His life had become a maze, one lie overlaid upon another until he was not sure he could untangle them if he had to. "The goddamn dog," he said out loud. "She doesn't have good sense," was how Al put it. She was a sneak, besides. The moment the back door was left open and everyone gone, she'd pry open the screen, come through to the living room, and urinate on the carpet. There were at least a half dozen map-shaped stains on it right now. But her favorite place was the utility room, where she could root in the dirty clothes so that all of the shorts and panties now had crotch or seat chewed away. And she chewed through the antenna wires on the outside of the house. And once Al pulled into the drive and found her lying in the front yard with one of his floor shimes in her mouth. "She's crazy," he'd say, "and she's driving me crazy. I can't make it fast enough to replace it. The son of a bitch, I'm going to kill her one of these days." Betty tolerated the dog at greater durations, would go along apparently unruffled for a time, but suddenly she would come upon it with fists clenched, call it a bastard, a bitch, shriek at the kids about keeping it out of their room, the living room, etc. Betty was that way with the children, too. She could go along with them just so far, let them get away with just so much, and then she would turn on them savagely and slap their faces, screaming, "Stop it! Stop it! I can't stand any more of it!" But then Betty would say, "It's their first dog. You remember how fond you must have been of your first dog." "My dog had brains," he would say. "It was an Irish setter." The afternoon passed. Betty and the kids returned from someplace or another in the car, and they all had sandwiches and potato chips on the patio. He fell asleep on the grass, and when he woke, it was nearly evening. He showered, shaved, put on slacks and a clean shirt. He felt rested but sluggish. He dressed and he thought of Jill. He thought of Betty and Alex and Mary and Sandy and Susie. He felt drugged. "We'll have supper pretty soon," Betty said, coming to the bathroom door and staring at him. "That's all right. I'm not hungry. Too hot to eat," he said, fiddling with his shirt collar. "I might drive over to Carl's, shoot a few games of pool, have a couple of beers," she said. "I see," he said. "Jesus," she said. "Go ahead. I don't care," he said. "I won't be gone long," she said. "Go ahead," I said. "I said I don't care." In the garage, he said, "God damn you all," and kicked the rake across the cement floor. Then he lit a cigarette and tried to get hold of himself. He picked up the rake and put it away where it belonged. He was muttering to himself, saying, "Order, order," when the dog came up to the garage, sniffed around the door, and looked in. "Here. Come here, Susie. Here, girl," he called. The dog wagged her tail but stayed where she was. He went over to the cupboard above the lawnmower and took down one, then two, and finally three cans of food. "All you want tonight, Susie, old girl. All you can eat," he coaxed, opening up both ends of the first can and sliding the mess into the dog's dish. He drove around for nearly an hour, not able to decide on a place. If he dropped her off in just any neighborhood and the pound were called, the dog would be back at the house in a day or two. The county pound was the first place Betty would call. He remembered reading stories about lost dogs finding their way hundreds of miles back home again. He remembered crime programs where someone saw a license number and the thought made his heart jump. Held up to public view without all the facts being in, it'd be a shameful thing to be caught abandoning a dog. He would have to find the right place. He drove over near the American River. The dog needed to get out more anyway, get the feel of the wind on its back, be able to swim and wade in the river when it wanted. It was a pity to keep a dog fenced in all the time. But the fields near the levee seemed too desolate, no houses around at all. After all, he did want the dog to be found and cared for. A large old two-story house was what he had in mind, with happy, well-behaved, reasonable children who needed a dog, who desperately needed a dog. But there were no old two-story houses here, not a one. He drove back onto the highway. He had not been able to look at the dog since he'd managed to get her into the car. She lay quietly on the back seat now, but when he pulled off the road and stopped the car, she sat up and whined, looking around. He stopped at a bar, rolled all the car windows down before he went inside. He stayed nearly an hour, drinking beer and playing the shuffleboard. He kept wondering if he should have left all the doors ajar, too. When he went back outside, Susie sat up in the seat and rolled her lips back, showing her teeth. He got in and started off again. Then he thought of the place. The neighborhood where they used to live, swarming with kids and just across the line in Yolo County. That would be just the right place. If the dog were picked up, it would be taken to the Woodland Pound, not the pound in Sacramento. Just drive onto one of the streets in the old neighborhood, stop, throw out a handful of the shit she ate, open the door, a little assistance in the way of a push, and out she'd go while he took off. Done. It would be done. He stepped on it getting out there. There were porch lights on, and at three or four houses, he saw men and women sitting on the front steps as he drove by. He cruised along, and when he came to his old house, he slowed down almost to a stop and stared at the front door, the porch, the lighted windows. He felt even more insubstantial, looking at the house. He had lived there, how long? A year, 16 months? Before that, Chico, Red Bluff, Tacoma, Portland, where he'd met Betty, Yakima, Toppenish, where he was born and went to high school. Not since he was a kid, it seemed to him, had he known what it was to be free from worry and worse. He thought of summers fishing and camping in the Cascades, autumns when he'd hunt pheasants behind Sam, the setter's flashing red coat a beacon through cornfields and alfalfa meadows where the boy that he was and the dog that he had would both run like mad. He wished he could keep driving and driving tonight until he was driving onto the old bricked main street of Toppenish, turning left at the first light, then left again, stopping when he came to where his mother lived, and never, never, for any reason, ever, ever leave again. He came to the darkened end of the street. There was a large empty field straight ahead, and the street turned to the right, skirting it. For almost a block, there were no houses on the side nearer the field, and only one house, completely dark, on the other side. He stopped the car, and without thinking any longer about what he was doing, scooped a handful of dog food up, leaned over the seat, opened the back door nearer the field, threw the stuff out, and said, "Go on, Susie." He pushed her until she jumped down reluctantly. He leaned over farther, pulled the door shut, and drove off slowly. Then he drove faster and faster. He stopped at Dupee's, the first bar he came to on the way back to Sacramento. He was jumpy and perspiring. He didn't feel exactly unburdened or relieved, as he had thought he would feel, but he kept assuring himself it was a step in the right direction, that the good feeling would settle on him tomorrow. The thing to do was to wait it out. After four beers, a girl in a turtleneck sweater and sandals and carrying a suitcase sat down beside him. She set the suitcase between the stools. She seemed to know the bartender, and the bartender had something to say to her whenever he came by, once or twice stopping briefly to talk. She told Al her name was Molly, but she wouldn't let him buy her a beer. Instead, she offered to eat half a pizza. He smiled at her, and she smiled back. He took out his cigarettes and his lighter and put them on the bar.
"Pizza it is," he said.
Later, he said,
"Can I give you a lift somewhere?"
"No, thanks. I'm waiting for someone," she said. He said,
"Where are you heading for?"
She said, "No place." "Oh," she said, touching the suitcase with her toe. "You mean that?" laughing. "I live here in West Sac. I'm not going any place. It's just a washing machine motor inside belongs to my mother. Jerry, that's the bartender, he's good at fixing things. Jerry said he'd fix it for nothing."
Al got up.
He weaved a little as he leaned over her. He said,
"Well, goodbye, honey. I'll see you around."
"You bet," she said, "and thanks for the pizza. Hadn't eaten since lunch. Been trying to take some of this off. She raised her sweater, gathered a handful of flesh at the waist.
Sure I can't give you a lift someplace, he said.
The woman shook her head. In the car again, driving, he reached for his cigarettes and then, frantically, for his lighter, remembering leaving everything on the bar.
The hell with it, he thought. Let her have it.
Let her put the lighter and the cigarettes in the suitcase along with the washing machine. He chalked it up against the dog, one more expense. But the last, by God, it angered him now. Now that he was getting things in order, that the girl hadn't been more friendly. If he'd been in a different frame of mind, he could have picked her up. But when you're depressed, it shows all over you, even the way you light a cigarette. He decided to go see Jill. He stopped at a liquor store and bought a pint of whiskey and climbed the stairs to her apartment, and he stopped at the landing to catch his breath and to clean his teeth with his tongue. He could still taste the mushrooms from the pizza, and his mouth and throat were seared from the whiskey. He realized that what he wanted to do was go right to Jill's bathroom and use her toothbrush. He knocked.
It's me, Al, he whispered.
Al, he said louder. He heard her feet hit the floor. She threw the lock and then tried to undo the chain as he leaned heavily against the door.
Just a minute, honey. Al, you have to quit pushing. I can't unhook it.
There, she said and opened the door, scanning his face as she took him by the hand. They embraced clumsily, and he kissed her on the cheek.
Sit down, honey. Here.
She switched on a lamp and helped him to the couch. Then she touched her fingers to her curlers and said,
I'll put on some lipstick. What would you like in the meantime? Coffee? Juice? A beer? I think I have some beer. What do you have there? Whiskey? What would you like, honey?
She stroked his hair with one hand and leaned over him, gazing into his eyes.
Poor baby, what would you like? She said.
Just want you to hold me, he said. Here, sit down. No lipstick,
he said, pulling her onto his lap.
Hold, I'm falling, he said.
She put an arm around his shoulders. She said,
You come on over to the bed, baby. I'll give you what you like.
Tell you, Jill, he said. Skating on thin ice. Crash through any minute. I don't know.
He stared at her with a fixed, puffy expression that he could feel but not correct.
Serious, he said.
She nodded.
Don't think about anything, baby. Just relax, she said.
She pulled his face to hers and kissed him on the forehead and then the lips. She turned slightly on his lap and said,
No, don't move, Al.
The fingers of both hands suddenly slipping around the back of his neck and gripping his face at the same time. His eyes wobbled around the room an instant, then tried to focus on what she was doing. She held his head in place in her strong fingers. With her thumbnails, she was squeezing out a blackhead to the side of his nose.
Sit still, she said.
No, he said. Don't. Stop. Not in the mood for that.
I almost have it. Sit still, I said. There, look at that. What do you think of that? Didn't know that was there, did you? Now just one more, a big one, baby. The last one, she said.
Bathroom, he said, forcing her off, freeing his way.
At home, it was all tears, confusion. Mary ran out to the car, crying before he could get parked.
Susie's gone,
she sobbed.
Susie's gone. She's never coming back, Daddy. I know it. She's gone.
My God, heart lurching. What have I done? No, don't worry, sweetheart. She's probably just off running around somewhere. She'll be back, he said.
She isn't, Daddy. I know she isn't. Mama said we may have to get another dog.
Wouldn't that be all right, honey? He said. Another dog if Susie doesn't come back? We'll go to the pet store.
I don't want another dog,
the child cried, holding onto his leg.
Can we have a monkey, Daddy, instead of a dog? Alex asked. If we go to the pet store to look for a dog, can we have a monkey instead?
I don't want a monkey, Mary cried. I want Susie.
Everybody let go now. Let Daddy in the house. Daddy has a terrible, terrible headache, he said.
Betty lifted a casserole dish from the oven. She looked tired, irritable, older. She didn't look at him.
The kids tell you Susie's gone? I've combed the neighborhood. Everywhere, I swear.
That dog'll turn up, he said. Probably just running around somewhere. That dog'll come back, he said.
Seriously, she said, turning to him with her hands on her hips. I think it's something else. I think she might have got hit by a car. I want you to drive around. The kids called her last night and she was gone then. That's the last's been seen of her. I called the pound and described her to them, but they said all their trucks aren't in yet. I'm supposed to call again in the morning.
He went into the bathroom and could hear her still going on. He began to run the water in the sink, wondering, with a fluttery sensation in his stomach, how grave exactly was his mistake. When he turned off the faucets, he could still hear her. He kept staring at the sink.
Did you hear me? She called. I want you to drive around and look for her after supper. The kids can go with you and look too.
Al?
Yes, yes, he answered.
What?
She said.
What'd you say?
I said yes. Yes, all right, anything. Just let me wash up first, will you?
She looked through from the kitchen.
Well, what in the hell is eating you? I didn't ask you to get drunk last night, did I? I've had enough of it, I can tell you. I've had a hell of a day, if you want to know. Alex waking me up at 5 this morning, getting in with me, telling me his daddy was snoring so loud that you scared him. I saw you out there with your clothes on, passed out in the room smelling to high heaven. I tell you, I've had enough of it.
She looked around the kitchen quickly as if to seize something. He kicked the door shut. Everything was going to hell. While he was shaving, he stopped once and held the razor in his hand and looked at himself in the mirror. His face doughy, characterless. Immoral, that was the word. He laid the razor down.
I believe I have made the gravest mistake this time. I believe I have made the gravest mistake of all.
He brought the razor up to his throat and finished. He did not shower, did not change clothes.
Put my supper in the oven for me, he said, or in the refrigerator. I'm going out, right now, he said.
You can wait till after supper. The kids can go with you.
No, the hell with that. Let the kids eat supper. Look around here if they want. I'm not hungry and it'll be dark soon.
Is everybody going crazy? She said. I don't know what's going to happen to us. I'm ready for a nervous breakdown. I'm ready to lose my mind. What's going to happen to the kids if I lose my mind?
She slumped against the draining board, her face crumpled, tears rolling off her cheeks.
You don't love them anyway. You never have. It isn't the dog I'm worried about. It's us. It's us. I know you don't love me anymore, God damn you, but you don't even love the kids.
Betty, Betty, he said. My God, he said. Everything's going to be all right, I promise you, he said. Don't worry, he said. I promise you, things will be all right. I'll find the dog and then things will be all right, he said.
He bounded out of the house. Ducked into the bushes as he heard his children coming, the girl crying, saying, Susie, Susie. The boy saying maybe a train ran over her. When they were inside the house, he made a break for the car. He fretted at all the lights he had to wait for, bitterly resented the time lost when he stopped for gas. The sun was low and heavy, just over the squat range of hills at the far end of the valley. At best, he had an hour of daylight. He saw his whole life a ruin from here on in. If he lived another 50 years, hardly likely. He felt he'd never get over it, abandoning the dog. He felt he was finished if he didn't find the dog. A man who would get rid of a little dog wasn't worth a damn. That kind of man would do anything, would stop at nothing. He squirmed in the seat, kept staring into the swollen face of the sun as it moved lower into the hills. He knew the situation was all out of proportion now, but he couldn't help it. He knew he must somehow retrieve the dog.
as the night before he had known he must lose it.
"I'm the one going crazy,"
he said, and then nodded his head in agreement. He came in the other way this time, by the field where he had let her off, alert for any sign of movement.
"Let her be there," he said.
He stopped the car and searched the field. Then he drove on slowly. A station wagon with the motor idling was parked in the drive of the lone house, and he saw a well-dressed woman in heels come out the front door with a little girl. They stared at him as he passed. Farther on, he turned left, his eyes taking in the street and the yards on each side as far down as he could see. Nothing. Two kids with bicycles a block away stood beside a parked car.
"Hi,"
he said to the two boys as he pulled up alongside.
"You fellows see anything of a little white dog around today? A kind of white shaggy dog? I lost one."
One boy just gazed at him. The other said,
"I saw a lot of little kids playing with the dog over there this afternoon. The street the other side of this one. I don't know what kind of dog it was. It was white, maybe. There was a lot of kids."
"Okay, good. Thanks," Al said. "Thank you very, very much," he said.
He turned right at the end of the street. He concentrated on the street ahead. The sun had gone down now. It was nearly dark. Houses pitched side by side, trees, lawns, telephone poles, parked cars. It struck him as serene, untroubled. He could hear a man calling his children. He saw a woman in an apron step to the lighted door of her house.
"Is there still a chance for me?" Al said.
He felt tears spring to his eyes. He was amazed. He couldn't help but grin at himself and shake his head as he got out his handkerchief. Then he saw a group of children coming down the street. He waved to get their attention.
"You kids see anything of a little white dog?" Al said to them.
"Oh, sure," one boy said. "Is it your dog?"
Al nodded.
"We were just playing with him about a minute ago down the street, in Terry's yard." The boy pointed. "Down the street."